Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It's March 29th of 2017. It's our last WMR of the month. Chris, how you doing?
I thought you were about to say ever, and I got really worried. You're like, our last WMR ever. I'm dropping this on you now.
Just pull out a gun and shoot you through the camera.
Oh, man, that's a really dark ending to it. That's a great twist, but that is a dark ending.
This will be the last Weekly Manga Recap featuring Chris.
You know what? If you shoot me through the internet with a gun, I'm completely okay with you continuing on the show on yourself. Because clearly you have something,
he earned it.
You have something incredible going for you at this point, and I don't want to be the guy interrupting it at all.
We have to give Nick money so that he won't shoot us through the internet while he's talking about manga that he hates.
I'm like, essentially at this point, just he's obviously got the future in his hands. I don't want to be like, at least my life served a purpose, awakening this new side of Nick that's just worth it all the way through.
Your name will be written in the history books at the dawn of the new era.
I got a quick question for you, Nick.
All right.
Did you ever watch Survivor when it was on? Like, when it was that big film?
Absolutely not.
Are you aware with, like, the premise of it, though? Of, like,
yes,
people getting voted off? So, it's the NFL offseason.
I actually know more about Survivor from the Cartoon Network parody that they ran when it was really popular than anything else.
Non-stop Action Island or something?
I don't remember. No, not that one. I guess that is a Survivor parody, but that came much later. No, they would just run these little, you know, how Cartoon Network was in the late 90s and early 2000s, where they would have, like, crossovers between the characters and shows that they had on. So, you know, they threw in, like, you know, Blossom from the Powerpuff Girls, Eustace from Courage the Cowardly Dog, and I think they had Brack win the whole thing.
Of course fucking Brack did.
Of course Brack won.
The reason I bring it up is it's the NFL offseason, and the subreddit of the NFL decided to do an NFL Survivor game. And I think I've told you before also that there's, like, different groups that, like, get, like, teams get grouped into different categories in the subreddits. So, like, there's a subreddit for all the bird teams in the NFL and one for all the cat teams. And there's one particular one, which is the Evil League of Evil, which is the Patriots, the Giants, the Steelers, the 49ers, the Cowboys, the Bears, and the Packers. I think that's all of them. It's essentially all the teams that have long storied histories of winning, essentially, and are considered to be very good, and everyone hates them, but they're like, hey, we're evil, deal with it. So the Survivor
I'm not sure if currently the 49ers and Bears belong in that category, but almost, historically speaking, sure.
Almost every week someone asks to remove the Bears from the group because they've sucked for so long, but it's still the notion that, like, these are just teams of very long winning history. So people started this thing, and the immediate notion was like, well, let's kick out the Patriots. Let's eliminate the Patriots first. And the Evil League of Evil decided, like, put up votes in their subreddit. They're like, hey, guys, instead of, like, fighting each other, let's all band together, super
vote. We'll be the Legion of Doom.
Yeah, they're like, super vote one team out every time.
Yeah.
And we're going to, until we're the last seven teams, and then let it let be what let be. And it has worked phenomenally to the point where there's people who they've created the Coalition Against Evil is a new subreddit that started trying to stop them. And it's almost exclusively resulted in people going to other subreddits to beg them to help them stop the evil.
We have to work together.
The best part. So
the evil group has very contrary to how you normally think of, like, oh yeah, good guys can all be on the same page. Like, no, because good guys are all willing to fight each other the way that, you know, have a good honorable competition. The Evil League of Evil is like, let's just cheat. So
it's not cheating. It's a legitimate strategy.
Cheating, really not.
Yeah, they're
like when you have a bunch of evil people in a battle royal. They're like, we'll team up until it's just us, and eventually one of them betrays them. But they do really well at the start. Yeah,
but, like, that's how it's been going for so long. And the part about it I wanted to bring up is the levels of desperation are happening, because you think it'd be easy. The Patriots always have the second most number of votes. They just never get voted off. So you think the obvious notion would be like, well, just always vote Patriots if you're trying to stop this alliance, basically. But they never do. Every day someone in the coalition's like, let's do the Giants today, or let's do the 49ers, and it fucks up with the vote. But the part that makes me laugh is people are so desperate that they start posting at other subreddits, and someone got a link to R Furry, the furry subreddit. Someone being like, you have to help us stop this evil that's tearing the football subreddit apart. And it's just like, I fucking love watching this from the outside.
And then the furry community is like, wait, there's a team called the Bears? We're going to support the Evil League of Evil.
I love the notion that it's like, it's become such a like little cultural showcase in and of itself, where it's like, oh, this is the perfect strategy. The teams that are sure to be eliminated first, because everyone hates them, are all banding together and eliminating the teams with high popularity so that those guys will just get demoralized and not want to even bother voting anymore and just get to the end. And the good guys like can't coordinate shit and are begging the furry subreddits to start helping them.
What's that one game called where there's like a village of some sort?
Is it just called Werewolves?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I know the one you're talking about.
So I was part of an Avatar, The Last Airbender forum about 11 years ago. And someone on the forum started a game that, you know, had like an Avatar flavor to it. And we played two games that way. The first one went down to the wire because, you know, it got down to the point where there was like, you know, one firebender left. And if they, you know, managed to kill off one of the two remaining, then that meant that they would win, because 1-1, that means you win. And literally, like, it was just by a stroke of luck, because I knew, I forget exactly how it went, but like, I knew that if this guy, that if one of them voted one way, then that meant that he had to be the firebender. So I was like, okay, I correctly identified him. And it came down to just like a 50-50 shot at the very end. The other one, I got on the team with the werewolves or firebenders. And I basically just started, you know, I made like a direct messaging group thread with all the others. And I was like, guys, this is easy. We use our ability to kill one person each night. And then we all just vote the same way to kill someone. So we kill two people in a day, and they're going to be constantly outnumbered no matter what they do, so long as they don't get coordinated. And eventually somebody was catching on by like the fourth day in a row that we had done this. But by then it was too late.
Yeah, like once you outnumber them, you just systematically destroy them, and it's just this sad, inevitable fate.
So literally all that comes down to is, you know, you've got this tremendous advantage because you know who everyone on your side is. So you just have to be properly coordinated and be fucking ruthless about it.
There is a certain beauty to the notion that the subreddit for the teams that just happen to be the most successful and winningest teams also happens to have the fans who are the most coordinated
cutthroat,
but also logical and like solid thinking. Cause it's the teams who are trying to pretend they're the good guys that are screwing up and just can't decide who to vote for. Yet every day on the Evil League of Evil, there's a new post like, today, vote Ravens. And everyone does.
We're used to winning. We know how to do it.
Yeah, like this. I mean, it's been a while for the Bears, but logically, like, their parents must have, like, passed some of those genes down to them.
Plus, you know how Chicago people are. They can get that mob mentality down. You've seen what they're like at wrestling events.
You know what? I make
with their horribly ineffective, coordinated chance to get Daniel Bryan in the main event.
I may have to correct myself. There's one other thing that I find the best part about this. And this is a total football joke, so if you're not into football, I'm sorry. It's already been like 5 minutes, and you're like, what the fuck do they talk about manga? But I think my favorite part is that teams are now starting to like ask the Evil League of Evil for help. And the first team to come over was like the Texans. And they were like, we will band with you if you help us eliminate the Colts. And it happened. They were like, come in to us, brethren. And the Colts got eliminated the next day.
Some of you remember when you were Dallas fans, so we accept you.
I fucking loved it. It was like, we bring you the Texans subreddit for you. They're like, good, good. Tomorrow, the Colts. I love it.
You know, Colt, if you had decided to come over, we would remember when you had Peyton Manning and we would have taken you, but Texans, they got nothing. They understand the dark side.
They know what's up.
The Oilers were never good, but fuck it.
You're close enough. You have some pretty good players.
Oh, man. That's ridiculous. I fucking love that. That's great. Okay, so we do have manga to talk about. We're going to hold off one more week on Blue Exorcist because it's hella long. And we've been pretty busy this week getting bonus content ready for you guys. So should be ready to discuss that next week. In the meantime, I guess we'll just freaking get right into it. Our usual recap portion with the manga recap. So let's start off with My Hero Academia, number 131, Fighting Fate, with an awesome two-page spread to kick us off. Just got a bunch of the different student characters walking side by side the way badasses do. It looks really cool. Also, Ida has some battle damage on his helmet for some reason.
Well, everyone has a little bit. At first, I thought it was supposed to be like some kind of duality thing, like one side was always like more battle damage than the other, because you could see like Uraraka's bodysuit's a little damaged by her right leg or left leg, and her arm on the left side's kind of torn up, and Deku has a little bit of wear and tear as well. But I guess it's just supposed to be as though they just came out of, I guess,
a really came out battle. Of a fight. Good guys don't look at cool guys don't look at explosions, kind of thing.
The thing to note about this, though, that I find particularly interesting is that, one, Ida's on here. It's been a while since I felt like Ida's been considered a main character, but also Suyu is on here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, she's getting popular, so.
She is, but considering at the end of this chapter, Kirishima is noted as being someone who's going to be significant, I thought it was surprising. I mean, she's also noted, so there is that, but Kirishima I could have easily seen fill that spot, too, so I think it's a good sign if you're a Suyu fan that she is appearing on this page.
I feel like if Suyu were by herself in this picture, like didn't have all the others around her, that she would look really creepy, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Just the way that she's looking directly into your soul.
With, like, the hands limped over, too. Tangent, Nick. I know we just got done.
Not too late.
did you see the trailer for It? The It remake doing?
No.
I don't know how to feel about it, because it seemed like it was going to be scary at first, but then they showed what he looks like. I don't know why. He looks like he shit his pants when he starts running at the main character, like he starts waddling like a fucking crab.
What, Pennyworth?
Yeah, Pennywise.
Oh, right.
It seems like it could be scary. I still am always going to be demoralized by the fact that I know this story ends with them fighting a giant spider in the sewers, which is still stupid as shit.
Don't forget the important part that the girl in their group was like, we're going to die, so I want to have sex with all of you.
Now,
never forget that. That's super creepy.
It is very strange. 12. It is very strange, but that's not in the TV special, which is where my knowledge of this comes from. However, it did include the giant fucking spider in the sewers that they defeat by, like, shooting a piece of silver
asthma medication.
I'm like, this is the stupidest. Why is it a giant spider?
All right. So, last time in My Hero Academia, All Might revealed to Deku that Sir Nidai used his foresight ability on him and saw that he would die in battle. Deku is quite concerned, obviously, by this. Like, he's kind of shocked at the start of the chapter as it all sinks in. There's some kind of over-the-top narration that I think is a little bit unnecessary, because it's like, hearing it from All Might himself cut me like a knife. Reality sometimes hits you hard like that. Okay, Izuku. Alright, yeah, you go write your teen novel or whatever, man. Okay, so, and we get a flashback from Toshinori's perspective of Sir Nidai freaking out at him over the phone that he's chosen, you know, a quirkless middle schooler as the new symbol of peace. He's like, oh, come on, there's so many other suitable candidates, you can't do that. And Toshinori says, yes, there are plenty of good choices, but this quirkless kid is as good as any. And that was really more the end, the final part of their split, because after that, that was it. Okay, they have like not talked to each other at all. Sir Nidai has taken into Gata under his wing and kind of pursued that path instead. So Deku freaks out and starts yelling at All Might. He's like, when is this supposed to happen? Is it really inevitable? Toshinori says, well, he said it would happen within 6 to 7 years after he saw it, which Deku calculates quickly. He's like, oh, well, that means it's going to be this year or next year. So, I mean, he says, this is ridiculous. You know, I at the sports festival, I made a promise to you, and I haven't come through on that yet. I need to be able to tell the world that I am here, and you have to be alive until that day, at least. And Toshinori says that, you know, when he first heard the prediction, he actually just accepted it without question. With the goal in sight, I figured I'd just finish with the sprint. But my fight against All For One and Kamina was my finish line. But you were there. You, timid and quirkless, have been there for me all these months. Our days together spoke to me, telling me to live. Then your mother told me to live so I could raise and protect you right. So even now I'm fighting to live. You changed my outlook. I'm still alive. And he transforms into his All Might form briefly and says, and I'll use this very hand to shape my own fate. So, big heroic moment for him, even though, I mean, it dissipates almost immediately after he's done saying that, and you can tell that he's very haggard even while he's in that form. I'll admit the first time I read this that I was kind of like, so is this supposed to be like a kind of a happy moment? Because certainly afterward, there's kind of some awkwardness between them because he's like, yeah, I'll, you know, resist fate.
It's still like a thing where it's like, I mean, the situation here is that you're going to die.
Right.
And it's not like he's like, well, that's never going to happen. It's just like, it may not happen this year. I may not die this year. Maybe.
Deku's got a moment where he's like, I won't accept it. And he does have this heroic moment where he says, you know, I'll be there no matter what happens, and I'll be there to change fate by your side. And Toshinori kind of jokes with him because he holds his hand, and he's like, well, just don't mess up your hand while you're doing it, because you've got self-destructive potential here. And Deku brings up the very logical point of, hey, maybe you could get Sir Naida to just use his quirk on you again, because maybe since then your fate has changed. And Toshinori's like, nah, that'd be kind of awkward. And Deku's like, well, this is your life we're talking about, though. Isn't it important to know? Well, we should consider his feelings, though. Now, that's just the end of the scene.
Yeah.
It's a very awkward, like, It feels like this sequence has, you know, this big, you know, because All Might gives this big speech, and he's like, you know, it's like, I thought I was going to die, but you were there, and I kept on going even after the point that I thought I was going to die. So, I'm just going to keep on going until the very end, no matter what happens, and not worry about it, and I'll do my best. And Deku says, yeah, and I'll be there with you. And then they're just going to trail off. And
I wonder if... I'm wondering if all of this will play out a lot better in the collected volumes. Because as it is now, I almost feel like the scene's out of place. Like, it should have been somewhere else in the story. Like, maybe putting this somewhere after the UA exams, or... I don't know, just putting it somewhere closer to the actual confrontation with All For One. Because as it is here, it just kind of feels separate. Like, it didn't feel like this was, like, a major thing. Like, I know this has been an ongoing part of their relationship, but it didn't feel as though it was significant to address it now as opposed to another time. However...
Or maybe it should have happened, like, right after Deku met with Sir Naidai and joined his organization, so that they do that, they have this conversation... And then he goes on patrol with Tagata. Yeah.
It just feels like it's weirdly kind of placed in that we had, like, this break with the meeting Plague Mask dude, whose name I've just forgotten, even though you just literally said it. Again, it might flow better with the entire collected volume. Maybe it does kind of feel like it transitions a little bit better. It's just right here, I was like, huh, that's kind of a weird place to put this moment, essentially. So I think it kind of undercuts it a small bit.
Mm-hmm. But things don't end there. we cut to a completely different scene where essentially it's the site of a kaiju battle. These two villains who are both, they both have gigantification quirks, are fighting and wrecking buildings in the middle of their fight until, Hado, the, girl in the UA Big Three appears on the scene and attacks them with, I'm not sure if it's like electricity or lasers or what come out of her wrists.
It looks like it's water almost.
It almost does look like it's water, but she says she's like charging it up and it's hard to see. It's hard to tell exactly.
It probably is energy. Now that I look at it closer, I guess the first time I saw it, I was on a smaller screen. So it just kind of, I just assumed it was water and I don't know why I thought she had like she shells on her head. But it probably is energy because the sound effect is like flick, flick, and it has kind of like that jagged edge to it that makes it just seem like energy of some kind.
So she knocks them both down with a blast of some sort, and then she calls out to the two that are with her, Froppy and Uravity! And so last chapter we kind of briefly mentioned that they said that Suyu and Uraraka and Kirishima were all missing. Well, it turns out that they were off doing hero internship stuff.
I forgot how stupid their names are, particularly Uraraka's. It's probably
Uravity!
It's probably a pun that sounds fantastic in Japanese, but translated that way in English makes it sound real. Like, I just don't get
No, that's, I'm pretty sure that that is just, like, her name.
Uravity.
Like, gravity and Uraraka. Uravity.
Yeah, it's just that moment where you're just like, what does that mean? Like, I feel like if I was, like, a spectator in this world, I'd be like, so, like, are you gravity, and that's the joke? Like an iPod kind of thing? Like, you gravity? Or are you like a rave character, and that's what's in there? Or are you a vacuum cleaner? What's going on? I don't get what you are. What does this name mean? This is nonsense. Froppy, I guess.
It is interesting how, like, some of the names that they've come up with are much better than others. Like, you know, Kirishima, at the end of the chapter, you know, he shows up in a big split panel, and he has his superhero name is Red Riot.
And the dude he's with,
yeah.
Sun Eater. I'm like, that's a
awesome
cool name. Sir Night Eye Works, Lay Million. I mean, it's a,
you know.
Okay. But, yeah, like, those
Deku,
names are great.
Well, it's easy to say.
I'm like, you have a not pronounceable name that I don't mistake for someone else. I like that.
And then there's it turns out that they're working, that the girl students are working for the number 9 hero, the Dragoon hero, Ryukyu, which, you know, that sounds pretty good, and it has to do with, like, a dragon name. So, all right, that's fine. But yeah, there are some names that are much lamer than others in the world of My Hero Academia.
It's one of those names that I feel like when she did her hero provision or the work study that, like, what was it, Gunhead, I think she worked with or whatever, Gunmetal.
Right, yeah.
Should have definitely pulled her aside, like, all right, so we got to
listen.
I know you're young. You thought it was really cool at the time. You need a better name. Look, if I could go back in time and tell myself, like, look, I know Lord Von Quack sounds hilarious, but you don't want to be associated with that name a year from now. Look, Rollo T isn't even that great. All right? Come up with something better.
Hey, you think that's bad? Try Wild Ruler of Time.
True.
Oh, well, thanks.
I'm just saying, I have not seen as many questions come into the WMR mailbox that are like, what does Rollo T stand for, as opposed to what does Why Ruler Time stand for?
Look, I was 14. All right. So we get a bit of a conversation with Ryukyu and the students, and she congratulates them on doing a good job in helping to take down the kaiju villains. And she says, hey, you know, you're showing great promise as fighters during the study, so I think that you could be helpful to us on a case that we're going to be working on. And she says that they're going to be teaming up with All Might's former psychic, Sir Night Eye, to help him out. And not only that, but presumably Sun Eater and his new protege, Red Riot, are also going to be doing so. And she says that it's regarding the investigation of Shie Hasekai, as we see that Overhaul is preparing to meet with Shigaraki.
Yes.
So finally getting that meeting that we were promised a couple of chapters ago.
I am intrigued. I'm excited to see how this goes down. More kind of curious the fact they're actually meeting face-to-face. I wonder if Shigaraki's going to go along with this. Now, I suppose he probably could on the notion of, like, pretending to play along with it. Because that does seem like the better villain move to be like, yeah, sure, I'll agree with you, and then just take the power from him as soon as it can possibly come about. But yeah, I'm excited for this.
Yeah.
So hold on, this is just something I noticed. Sun Eater, he's wearing a hood, but is this hood open in the back? Because you can see his hair poking out of the back of his hood. Like right underneath his name, you can see like points of his hair poking out. Yeah.
I don't know.
Part of me is is this a clue to his quirk? Or I'm like, is this just another stupid design, like the fact that Jotaro's hat goes into his hair and just disappears?
Well, it could also be like some sort of ornamentation on the hood that in black and white has the same shade as his hair, too.
It could. I choose to believe he has a stupid hood.
I was much more pleased with the second half of this chapter than the first half because it was just kind of awkward all around their conversation. So,
I'm excited for it. I think I'm intrigued to see it. I like getting a little bit more of the big three as well. We now know all their hero names, and we got at least an idea of two of their powers as well. So I'm really excited to see what they do. And I'm actually very excited, I guess, to find out what Sun Eater's power is and why Kirishima would be the student he'd bring along.
I eat suns!
I'm like, that's an incredible power. You are broken, sir.
Why are you not a villain?
Why aren't you the biggest hero in the universe right now? So yeah, I like this chapter. I'm really excited to see next week's. That's, I think, my big thing right now, is I want to catch that basically immediately.
All right,
so let's jump into Fairy Tail then. Chapter 528, Dragon of Magic. And I actually want to give Hiro a shout-out, because I like that this cover page features one of the very, very early villains of Fairy Tail. I think his name was Reaper or something like that. It was one, basically the first major antagonist that Natsu and them fought. I think actually at a time before Urza was actually introduced to the story yet. I don't think she was a part at that at this point, because this was basically the first big opponent Natsu fought. So
the last couple of weeks have been kind of flashbacks to the early days of Fairy Tail.
So, yeah, I like that. I like getting that call back to a very old part of the series. God, that has to be like probably over a decade ago at this point. Maybe not
right around there.
Maybe not that far, but yeah, just about. Jesus. All right. So we're cutting away from all the Xerath and Natsu stuff that happened last week and returning back to Actalogia, who, if you recall, was stomping the shit out of Irene's body in front
which he is still doing as this chapter begins. Apparently he's just been doing it for several minutes as Wendy and Urza look on in horror.
Yeah, he's just stomping a mud hole at Urza's dead mother as he laughs the entire time, like, ha ha ha, stop, 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 ha ha ha, stop, stop, stop. And Urza, finally after like a minute and a half, is like, stop. And he just looks at her, he's like, you smell like she does.
And Wendy, I should know.
Yeah, I've been stepping on her for a while now. And Wendy starts freaking out because just like he immediately, I guess, senses the Dragon Slayer magic in her. And he makes a comment about like, what a brat this small is that kind of power. He actually like throws an attack at them. And Gerard, I think is?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. He has like six different fucking names. And he's the same fucking character for Brave Master. Gerard shows up and blocks. Jalal, I forgot, is the translated name for him. Jalal. Stupid name. Jalal blocks it, starts attacking back with this, you know, big attack with seven fucking stars and seven sword, lightning, grand chariot attack. And Actalogia just laughs the entire time as he just devours all of it. He's literally going like, ha 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 ha, nom 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 nom. And everyone's like, what's he doing? He's eating the magic. What aspect does he have? If he's a dragon, you know, what element is he? And he's like, aspect, I don't have one. I am the ultimate dragon, the Omega Dragon who devours all magic. I am the Dragon of Magic, Actalogia. And he does this in this big, pose as he's reverted to being a dragon and just towers over all of them in this terrifying display.
It's such a badass moment.
Yes.
The moment of the reveal where it's like, he can eat all magic, and then he's raw full dragon form!
And they note, they're like, wait, if he eats all magic, does that mean all magic won't work on him? And
because dragon slayers have resistance to their affinity, so...
If his affinity is magic, yeah, if he's like, I'm colorless, you're like, shit! He has no weakness, not at all, fuck!
God damn it, he's like Spirit Tomb!
So, Wendy's like, I have to do my part because I'm a Dragon Slayer. And she just goes Super Saiyan.
She does her Super Dragon Slayer second form thing.
Yeah, Over Soul or Dragon Soul, I think is. I forget. Everything just says Dragon in it, so I forget what the specific term, Dragon Force. I can't remember if that's what it's called or not.
But I think it is Dragon Force.
I don't know why. I guess it's because I've been watching more and more Dragon Ball recently. It's just, I can't look at this and not be like, I'm gonna kill them all! Ah!
Just specifically because she's got like four word bubbles surrounding her, which are all going, ah!
It's actually for me more the fact that there's like three panels right before this of her with pigtails, and in that panel, the hairpins exploded off, and she just has fucking Saiyan hair as this power beam has like appeared behind her. So she's preparing to do something, and Akalaji is about to attack. But before he can, a fucking ship crashes into him and just knocks him away. And up to this point, I was like, this chapter is great. Akalaji is awesome. A fucking ship crashed into him. This
the only
is
thing
awful.
That could possibly ruin this chapter is if Ichiya showed up. Fuck!
As long as the worst character in Fairy Tail doesn't show up, we'll be fine. Well, actually, this was going to be fine, too, because he shows up, the fucking perfume dude. And I was like, good. He's going to die in this last-minute effort to save the characters. He was going to be like, it's all I can do. Actology is too strong. I'm just going to fucking crash myself into him. And that should be enough to delay him, hopefully, for you guys to escape. But instead, he fucking... I don't know. I guess the drag... Like, Actology is like, I can devour all magic. But ships hurt. Cause he's
wood? Wood. Fuck wood.
He just passes out for a couple minutes while fucking... And she was like, get on the ship. I'll explain everything to you. Hold on. Let's have a conversation. They do. Everyone gets on the ship, and Akalaji, who can just shoot magic out of his mouth, can shoot nukes, just like watches them like fly away, like, oh, I'll get you next time!
Oh, damn it, a flying ship! If only I had wings so I could fight.
If only I was some kind of flying creature, perhaps one with a long range projectile attack of great power and destructive force.
Maybe he's just got a concussion from the ship hitting him.
Or he's just staring like, did you just hit me with the fucking ship? What did you just... Motherfucker! Did the perfume dickhead in this series just hit me at the Logia with a goddamn ship? Bitch, I'm going to fucking flay you! But yeah, Ichiyu shows up, rescues all of them, and is telling them that all hope is not lost. They might still have a way to defeat Actalagia if they lure him to a certain place. And that's when they're like, what? Is that truly possible? And a character who we can't see the face of says, yes, it is true. And
I have no idea who this is supposed to be.
I feel as though this is someone I should know.
Because there is a reaction shock at the sight of her.
So. But I can't think of who it would be yet.
Too many side characters in Fairy Tail.
Too many side characters, and I can't... I'm like, is this someone related to Blue Pegasus? Because if so, fuck you. I don't care about that guild. Like, I think if it's someone of, like, a guild...
It's
going to
be old
tier
again.
if it's the old woman from Fairy Tail, I don't care. I don't know who this is. And I can't decide. If it's old tier, I'm going to be fucking infuriated. I'm like, she already
I
had
I came back from the dead again, and my hairstyle is different this time.
Oh, God. Or what if it's... Fuck, what's Lucy's mom's name?
Layla.
If it's fucking Layla or something like that. I'm just like, it has to be somewhat important, but...
He's like, I'm past Lucy.
Future Rogue shows up again to help everyone out. It's like, get out of here! You suck!
I'll kill all of you. And then Gray hugs Frosch. Never mind.
He just starts crying. He's like, this is all I wanted in life. It's like, take you and your shitty cat and get out of here.
So this was a great 16 page chapter, but on pages 17 and 18, I was like, fuck it.
I was so invested in it. You had me immediately in just the last moment where it's just like, why does it have to be fucking Ishii? Why can this character not get the death he so rightfully deserves for being this annoying?
Oh, man.
But,
all right.
Yeah.
I'll take a 90% good.
That's
better than normal. So
it's not mind-numbingly frustrating. It's just one of those things where you're like, I wish anyone else had done this, basically.
Pretty much. Okay. Let's go over to Food Wars Chokugeki no Soma. Chapter 208, Staying Grounded. Last time we began the 3-on-3 match to start off the big team Chokugeki, and Soma is taking on Karakuni. I think that's how you say her name. I'm sure I got that wrong. The glasses girl in the council who specializes in Soba, and of course, it turned out the theme of their match is, Soba, because Soma is unlucky.
This is, Kinokuni is her name, but...
Kinokuni.
What's weird to me, we joke about it a bit when it comes to Black Clover, how Yuno always shows up in the front when he's not in there. The choices for this week's cover is interesting. It's just Soma, Azami, and Joichiro.
I guess they're all there.
They're all very significant, but the other two aren't doing anything right now, and Kinokuni's actually in this match in a very significant character.
Ishiki gets a full page color to start off, to start things off, and he's not one of the named characters.
Yeah. It's interesting that those two make it on there. I wonder,
Also, the MC of the match, Urara, she gets her introductory panel again.
Yeah, and they have to explain again as though people like didn't remember from three chapters ago, like, she's brainwashed. I'm like, I didn't remember she was from this before.
Kinokuni looks over at Soma, and as she's doing so, she's actually thinking about Ishiki, like, oh, you know, you've had your eyes on him this whole time. Because Ishiki, you know, is kind of chilling to start things off. He's just observing, like, oh, man, look at Soma. He's so popular. And, you know, people are calling from the cage that they're observing from. Ishiki, you've got to start cooking, too. But Kinoku is thinking to herself, I know you've had your eye on him, but the theme of our match is Soba Noodles. There's no way he could do anything against me. And we get some insight into Kinokuni's upbringing and backstory, how she hasn't just been trained in traditional Japanese cuisine. She's, you know, been trained in all things that have to do with traditional Japanese culture, traditional dance, and judo, the naginata, the taishokoto, which I don't know what that is, all of this. I think it's the glaive-like thing. No, that's the naginata. I think taishokoto is the guitar. That's it. So, you know, she was isolated from people. Her friends would go off and play after school, but she would go home to training, and from a distance she would watch them, not really caring one way or another. And we get some insight into her, like, getting super into practicing calligraphy. So not only was she, like, kind of forced into this, traditional upbringing, learning all these traditional skills, but she really was fucking into it, which I like that take on it. You know, Nora is like, oh, she never got to do anything that she wanted to as a kid. She's never been happy. No, she's happy doing this. It's fine.
this is where she excels. And that would make sense. Like, it would be like, wait, there's another member of Central who's like, I'm secretly a great person on the inside, just force it. Yeah. It's like, no, let's go with something different. And it's like, she had that upbringing, but she fucking loathes it.
Yeah. So, Azami, you know, uses this opportunity to kind of do an impromptu sort of lesson, like, oh, hey, you know, observe the way that Kinokuni is using her hands. And he goes, if you have a hand fetish, then Chokugeki no Soma finally ticked that box for you with this chapter, because oh, she uses each of her five fingers and the thumb is kneading them, but the just look at the way that her hands move when kneading the dough. Just so, yeah, really, really into it for like this entire page. It's like, look at the way she prepares the soba dough. Okay.
And then in case you were like, I don't have a hand fetish. I'm a normal person. You're like, well, there's an ass fetish page for you on the next one.
Look at the way that she uses her legs to, she channels all of her power through her butt in order to get to channel it into the noodles. I never knew that Tsukihiro Sono was capable of being this sexual without taking a female character's clothes off.
Well, it's like that thing in Ice Shield 21 when they have to push the truck and they're like, look, the power is in your butt.
Yeah.
But that was a more comedic thing, so
right.
It works. But this one, I like this. Like, I mean, it's impossible to not sexualize it when you're like, the power is in their legs and hips. But yeah, at least she has clothes on and it's... I don't know, she's doing something cool, I guess.
The butt is the largest muscle in the body. So, everyone's freaking out just from observing her preparing the soba noodles. And even, like, some people inside the cage are drooling at the thought of what she's going to make. And Arina is thinking to herself, this is going to really suck because, you know, she is... It's plain to see just from her preparing this that... There's far more than a mere 3 years that's required to become a master behind this. She's been training her whole life doing this. And, then, you know, freaking to challenge Kinokuni, of course, Soma is preparing instant soba. And Soma's like, what? You know, come on. And, he does explain it eventually, but before that, we get, you know, Kinokuni saying, he's like, I know where your victories come from. You know, you use your creativity, spontaneous inspiration. You're unconventional in the way that you use secret ingredients. And then occasionally you use some sort of novel bluff. But this time, none of that will avail you anything. Only time and experience can bring out the true deliciousness of soba noodles and make them shine. You have neither. Do not think you can best me when it comes to soba. And she makes this big dramatic pose while a freaking oni mask appears behind her. I love whenever Shokugeki no Soma has one of those, like, oh, this is my skill kind of moments. Goes so over the top with it. It's cooking! We get someone saying, yeah, there's no way you could beat her, rebel scum.
Roger, roger.
So we get a flashback from Soma's perspective of Joichiro trying to prepare him. You know, Joichiro is saying, he's like, okay, how would you go about being one of the Council of Ten? And Soma's just like, oh, you know, I'd think on my feet, use some creativity, and, you know, beat him. And Joichiro's like, ah, so exactly what you did during the classic, which you lost. So he points out, you know, it's great that you have all that creativity and stuff, but you lost to Hayama back during that festival because he came at you with a single concentrated point of attack, fragrance. And on the Council of Ten, everyone's got that one specific talent that they've honed to a ridiculous degree of perfection. So quick thinking and a dash of creativity aren't going to be enough to get you past them. So remember, you do have one area where you've built up an unmatched level of knowledge and experience, just like they have. Family restaurant cooking. So, we come back to Soma, who's like, you know, thanks for the warning, Kinokuni, but I've got my own kind of soba noodles. And he just gets out this little roller and just starts kind of like cranking the dough out. He just looks so happy. Look at how pretty the dough comes out.
He's so astonished. Like, it's such an innocent discovery. He's like, wow, these new fashion noodle makers are amazing.
It golly comes out gee. So nicely.
We're just like, what are you doing? She's making hers by hand.
And everyone eventually starts like fucking cracking up and laughing. I was like, oh, can you believe that he's using a freaking hand roller instead? But some of the more knowledgeable ones among the observers know, it's like, oh, no, this is actually the best way to go about this. You know, there's no way he could possibly win with handmade soba. And Arina launches into this explanation, you know, saying, oh, it's handmade. People make the association immediately. It's like, it's handmade, but that doesn't automatically mean that that makes the noodles better. It only makes sense if you don't have a freaking master level chef in this category like Kinokuni to make it by hand, that, you know, if you're not good at making it by hand, it'll turn out worse than if you did actually use this processor, this way of more efficiently and reliably cranking it out. And Kinokuni is also observing, because she's getting a little bit worried, that the ratio of buckwheat flour to wheat flour in the dough is different, because she is using 9 parts buckwheat and 10% wheat flour, and Soma is doing Nihachi Soba, 80% buckwheat to 20% wheat. A common perception is the less wheat flour used and the closer 100% buckwheat the soba noodles are, the more refined they are. But that is a mistake. See, 100% buckwheat soba noodles have a stronger aroma, and they're naturally sweet. And,
put steak in this so I can care!
Well, she actually does kind of like say, like, see, to a layman who's not a freaking noodle connoisseur, the lack of gluten in more pure buckwheat soba makes them seem thin and crumbly. So he's actually doing something that a common person would more easily be, it would more easily be palatable to them. So I'm like, yes, that's exactly right. You know what they say about buckwheat, Chris.
No, Nick, I know all the common idioms in comparison to buckwheat. All of them. Don't let the buckwheat hit you on the way out the door. Buckwheat's got your tongue.
I mean, I do like the...
Pass the buckwheat. The buckwheat stops here. Hey, buddy, you got a buckwheat?
Man, Joe Buckwheat really blew that Super Bowl catch, didn't he? I will never forget Joe Buck's completely soulless reaction to David Tyree's helmet catch.
I fucking hate Joe Buck so much.
He's the most overrated fucking NFL announcer.
Eli
ever.
Manning goes back, tosses the ball, and it is caught for a gain. I'm like, this is the biggest play in Super Bowl history to this point. Emote, damn it.
Where's fucking Howie Mandel? He would be better at this.
I want somewhere out there. You know what?
Where's Howard Cosell? Bring in the spirit of Howard Cosell for this catch.
If I had unlimited money, I would redub that play with Booker T as the announcer. Because I bet Booker T would sell the shit out of that moment.
David Tyree going out with the greatest of ease.
He's going crazy, man. He's my top 5 receivers.
And Sin Cara, the one with the mark on his boot that lets you know he's the legit one, he makes that catch.
Sucky ducky, quack, quack, quack. The Giants just won the Super Bowl. Now can't you dig that? Soccer! Credits. The greatest Super Bowl of all time just got a little bit better.
Oh, man. So essentially, the conclusion Kinokuni draws from all this observation is, you know, the kind of noodles that you're making have a universal deliciousness to them that anyone who tastes them can love and enjoy. And those are exactly the kind of noodles that Soma could make. So, yeah. And, she's thinking to herself, the quality of Soma noodles at home, yeah, I'm way superior to that, but Soma's staying right there in my shadow, just one step behind me. But she remains confident because she's like, okay, I've got that one step still. It's still a big gap that you absolutely cannot take from me. So if you've got some sort of ace up your sleeve, well, let's see what you've got. So overall, I do like this chapter. It's, you know, a pure cooking chapter, but I like the way that it's built up. It's a very strong explanation of the things that are at play here. And, you know, we know enough about Soma's background that the point of, oh, you know, she's got that traditional background and he's got the more commoner background. It's a conflict of styles that's very easy to understand and get into.
It is. My only concern is that Azami ultimately is the soul, or not the soul, but it is the focal story of Shokugeki no Soma, in that it's the main kind of theme that they've been telling since the beginning, that there is not one right way to do things. There is multiple ways, and that's ultimately what Central's plan is. Everyone cooks the exact same way. My hope is that Kino Kuni in this match, we don't touch too much on that specific thing, which is what I'm kind of worried we might be getting to. They've distanced themselves a little bit by talking about her upbringing, but I hope they save more of that for when we get to the later parts, because that is the big point of Shokugeki no Soma, and I'd like to have like some really powerful moments left with that theme before we get to the exact end.
Yeah. We've got 8 different people to go through. So if you put that right in the forefront from the very beginning, then it's kind of like,
if we have to deal with it every match too, then
let's do it over and over again. Yeah.
But I'm excited for this. I'm curious to see what kind of is going to come across in this. And I like Kitty Kuni a lot. I like they've kind of developed her and given her some real big focus here.
Yeah. Liked it. Okay, from here we're going to move on to, we've only got the one jump start this week, which is Robot Laser Beam. Let's go into the series with the deliberately boring protagonist, who is unfortunately nonetheless kind of boring. I kind of want to get this through this one quickly, if I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no,
It's Chapter 2, Morning Robo. We do learn more about Robo's past, as, you know, his friend, Tomoya is still trying to get him into golf and failing. They mention in the conversation, because the president of the club is there as well, and, Robo mentions that, he's used to swinging a golf club because, of his dad's work. And, so as they part ways, he's like, so is he, does his dad do anything related to golf, or is he like a businessman who golfs a lot? And he's like, no, I think he's like a farmer. And he's a cook specifically. So of course Brendan's like, what the hell does that have to do with anything? We cut to see some of Robo's family life as he gets home, and they then head off into a rural area where he basically gardens his own vegetables, his dad does. And they have a good bit of a conversation along the way where Robo's like, is golf fun? And his dad's like, yeah, I think it's fun. You know, I was really super into it when I was younger. In fact, I was so obsessed with it that your mom got upset with me. And Robo's like, oh, well, if mother will be upset, then I will not bother. Robo goes off to do what is apparently his usual activity while his dad is tending the garden, which is he sets up a basket a distance and leans it against a tree and then just practices hitting golf balls into the basket from a distance. I guess that's fun to him.
If it's the one thing he's kind of found like as a pastime or whatever that he's like, this is okay, then yeah, I guess that's the best way to just practice golf.
It's like how if you're super bored and you don't have much to do, then, you know, like, pass you roll up your socks and throw them in the trash can over and over again. It's like that, you know?
I don't know that at all.
You never heard of that?
No. Why would you throw away your socks? Like, I get it, you're picking them out, but...
You pick them out.
Why don't you just throw a ball
against
the wall?
It's not like there's actually trash... Throw a ball against the wall... Practice hoops with a trash can, you know.
Why did you say practice? Like, why was your socks?
I literally have heard someone do that in a TV show once, so.
Alright. Fair enough.
Yeah. Tomoya catches up with Robo the next day and is like, you should play golf. I don't really care. Okay, you're gonna come with me and practice the driving course. I don't really agree to this, but... okay, I guess we're here. Fine. And meanwhile, coming out of it, out of the same golf course, or going around at the same time, is Yozan Miura, the super awesome pro golfer that we saw introduced in the last chapter. So Demoy's like, come on, just hit the ball. And Robo's like, okay. And he hits it, and Miura hears the super perfect golf stroke. He goes over to confront the guy, but Robo's like, here, you do it now. I'm going to the bathroom. And Tomoya's like, okay. And he does some super awful swings, and then Miura shows up, and Miura's like, I found you, super awesome golfer, so I challenge you. Let us see who is better. And that's the end of the chapter.
Yeah, I'm...
Golf is boring, Chris. Golf's boring. Like, it's always going to be boring.
It's boring, but I think with a more entertaining cast, it could be fine. Because I think table tennis is boring, but I loved Akihado Table or whatever it was. Akihado's Table Tennis. That one was amusing because it had a funny lead, and you were able to be like, okay, I could get into this. Golf is already, like, an uphill battle, but it's just the fact that, like, the protagonist is so dry that I can't get into it yet. I've tried, but every time I start reading into it, I just find myself, like, my ADD starts going off and starts thinking about, like, man, I wonder what would happen if I actually did make one of those stupid sports manga ideas I suggested at one point in time. And then I start going off on that tangent, and by the end, I'm like, wait, what happened in this chapter? And it's over by that point. I know there are people who really like this series, and I am very glad that people do, and I don't mean to be in a condescending way or anything like that. I'm legitimately glad people enjoy this, because I know this is the person who did Kuroko's Basket, and people would love to see more from him. It's just, me personally, I can't get into this thing. It's mainly the protagonist for me, and it's just a hard deal breaker to get over when you can't get into the protagonist at all.
I mean, maybe in the next chapter, Robo Reveal, he's, like, actually a cyborg and has, like, cybernetic enhancements or something like that.
That needed to be a chapter one reveal. You can't wait until chapter three for that.
Excuse me like that.
Look, U19 isn't even doing that hot, all right? You don't get the same luxury either. So you don't get to just shoot that out. Like, hey, chapter three, here's what shit is real.
Chapter five twist.
It's like, bitch, you ain't got time for that.
All right. Let's move on to The Promised Neverland, Chapter 32, Action 1, with another awesome color page as the cover. I really like just that visual of Emma clinging onto the rope and hanging from it. At the end of the last chapter, Ray asks Emma, who had seemingly fallen into despair, hey, you haven't actually given up, right? And Emma has the flashback, and we get another creepy shot of her face as she prepares to answer the question. We get a flashback of her, you know, thinking, I can't do anything. You know, Norman's gone. I couldn't manage to do anything. I have to think of something. What should I do? What should I be doing right now? Because, okay, Mom will be ruling us directly now. She'll control us without using Ray, so Mom's going to monitor us, directly monitor us. Specifically, she'll be monitoring me and Ray. So what I should be doing right now is nothing. Hide my claws. Hide my fangs. I know what Mom is looking for. I won't let her figure out or get in the way of our plans or objectives. Mom will be watching every subtle behavior and reaction. I can't let her suspect us. I can't do anything. I shouldn't do anything. So, yeah, that's it. She literally was just biding her time for 2 months while allowing Dawn and Gilda to move about and put their plans into action instead.
It's so hard to, like, I know we need to go through this in order, but Nick, I'd be like, what happened?
Okay. So.
Like, I'm like an antsy. I'm like, Nick!
All right. So Emma answers Ray, I haven't given up. And I bet you haven't either. And Ray's like, yeah, we're on the same page. We are playing the escape while pretending to have given up. Emma's like, I didn't want, her to figure anything out. We were laying down Gil to do stuff. And Emma says, okay, I think that we should run away tomorrow during the day. And Ray's like, I don't think so. I think we should escape at night. See, there's, you know, the cliff. We can't just scale down it. We've got to get out through the bridge. So there's two problems with escaping that way. One, Mom's going to be watching it. Then there's, of course, just security that's going to be on the bridge. There will be security there, absolutely. So here's what we're going to do. He just takes out a bunch of oil, and he's like, we're going to set the house on fire at night. So it's like, Emma's like, okay, I think I've got you so far. And Ray's like, yeah, so Mom will be distracted putting it out. Everyone will be let outside for an evacuation. We'll just take everyone outside while she deals with it. We'll also put some clay or something in the keyhole of the door that leads to the basement room so she won't be able to notify headquarters. Headquarters will think it's just a fire as opposed to arson and an escape. And then the security won't be focused on the bridge for a little while. We'll have a chance. Also, I've got these Molotov cocktails I've been making. And I was just like, Molotov!
What the fuck?
And Ray's like, don't take my 6 years of preparation lightly, Emma.
He's like, maybe you think that if you have baby memories, you don't think of every possible solution, but when you have baby memories, you do. Oh, my God.
So what we'll do is, you know, we're heading towards the bridge, you'll also throw Molotovs into the plants next door on the way to the bridge. So then there will be forest fires to deal with in other sections to provide an even greater distraction. So forget even waiting. Let's just run away tonight. You think you can do that? Can, you know, is your leg okay? And it's like, my leg's fine. Yeah, I can do it. And Ray's like, okay, let's do this. And he starts pouring oil on the floor.
I decided to go with an all-natural oil because it actually burns better. These are things you learn, Emma, when you have baby memories, which help you decipher information.
Okay. So Ray says, and I really like this moment that they have because Ray's like, okay, look, you know, this hallway that I'm going to be lighting is actually the furthest away from everyone's bedrooms. So listen, I'm still actually against the idea of taking everyone. I think it's impossible for us to get away, you know, with this, with our surroundings like this. I think we should at the very least leave the babies behind. But you're not going to listen if, even if I stop you, it's better than having you stay behind and not escape. So, that's it. That's the way I see things. And it's your decision in the end. So I like that he's, you know, just come forward and there's no more like deception, like, oh, I'm planning on, you know, banning things halfway through. It's like, you know, this is the way I see things, but I'm just going to leave it up to you at this point.
I'm giving you, I still don't like it. For the love of God, if you must, don't take the babies, but I'm not going to stop you.
Yeah. Especially because it's really hard to stop you when you're on fire. So,
well, Nick, I don't know what you mean by that.
So, Emma, is, you know, hesitating there, and Ray's like, what, go tell Don and Gilda and get away. And Emma says, you know, but what if we start the fire, Mom just decides to abandon the building? Wouldn't she just prioritize us over, you know, the house itself?
I can't, Nick, I can't anymore. The chat keeps doing fire puns nonstop. Ray might take some of the heat for this plan. This chapter's really been on fire recently. I can't, it's...
So Ray's like, you know, I already thought of that, though, so because I'm thinking about every possible solution. So it's okay, though. We've just got to make sure that the merchandise is in danger, too. So just pours oil all over himself, and he just starts going crazy, just grinning manically. He's like, this is awesome, isn't it? The perfect score with the set Shimadate will burn up. She won't be able to abandon it. I've been waiting for this day. I decided this a long time ago. Years. Many years ago. A childish retaliation. You know what, Emma? I've never really been interested in studying or reading. But I endured it. I worked hard to improve my value to the highest it could be. 12 years. I'm the feast they've been waiting and waiting for, and I'm going to take that away from them tonight. Right before the harvest they've been looking forward to. Don't think you can eat me. Don't think you can serve me. Food, merchandise, I don't give a crap. I'm a human being. Serves them right. But holy shit, man.
Well, in that, you're like, oh man, this is like pretty hard. Like, I like this as this idea that, like, when you've reached this point, that's kind of what remains of this, like, just kind of futile desperation where it's like,
yeah.
Like, it just seems like we can't get one over. But in every thought, I said, I'm going to be the best because I want to be as appealing to you as possible.
And just no matter what, that away from you.
Hell's heart, I'll stab at you. And it's actually his next moment that I think really I love most of all, because he says, that's fine. This is the best. I've watched my family die all these years, and I used them. But they were all good kids, and they were kind-hearted. And he has a moment where he's remembering all the people, all the kids that have died to this point. And you see that even though he's been using their deaths to kind of gain more information and play his slow game, he regrets it and he's sad and he actually cared for them. You're like, it's pretty heartbreaking.
And then just to top it all off, he gives Emma an album, or rather there's some pictures, there's stuff into a book. And he's like, I mean, I used the camera obviously for our escape plan, but I have also been using it to take pictures of the family. And there's even a picture of Norman and Emma together. And she, you know, Ray's like, all right, it's midnight. I'm 12 years old now. It was a life I wanted to curse, but the time I spent with you and Norman was really fun. Thank you. Goodbye, Emma. And he drops the match, and everything goes up in flames. And that's the end of the chapter.
What the fuck just happened, Nick? It's been 3 days now since I've read this chapter, and that is still my thought process of like, what the fuck just happened? This is insane. I don't know if it's like, this is 100% legitimate. I can't at this point even say, I can't even say if I like this or not, or if I'm furious. I'm just at this
it's
state of shock.
Such a shock.
If I can put this in context, this is, I imagine, what every person thought when they first read The Red Wedding in the George R. R. Martin books, where you're just like, what just happened? Holy shit, what are you
He's
doing? And that's exactly what I'm having here, where I'm just like, what the fuck just happened? This is insane. I finally felt like things were turning a corner, and then out of fucking nowhere, it looks like Ray just exploded himself. And it all makes sense. It's all logical. And it's heartbreaking. He has this moment of true humanity beforehand. But I'm just sitting here like, what just happened? Norman just sacrificed himself. Like, I don't know what's happening. And this is great. Like, I mean, for a story like this, you want it to be as unpredictable as possible. You want it to feel like you could never get a handle on it. But this was beyond words. This is easily one of the biggest twists of the year. I've already put it down on, like, our list for best twists of 2017. I also put it down for best what-the-fuck moments of 2017, which is usually reserved for stupid moments. But there was no other reaction I had this week after this scene happened where beyond just, like, what the fuck? I don't know. This is insane. This is absolutely one of the craziest things I've read in a Jump series in a while. Like, this is mind-boggling to me.
I mean, I still don't really know what to think of this, honestly. I mean, it was definitely a huge shock when I read it. After I had a bit, I was like, I wonder if he's actually dead. Because I've learned about at this point from The Promised Neverlands, like, there are so many goddamn twists and turns, and there's so much deception, specifically deception centered around Rey, that you can't trust frickin' anything that happens, that's going to be, you know, like, oh, well, it looks like he's dead. He's probably definitely dead. We got the huge hints of Norm being taken away, where of course you're supposed to be tipped off. No, he's not dead. But with this, it seems a lot more direct. But at the same time, it's like, he's like one of the main three characters. Are they actually going to kill him?
What's more difficult for me to think that he's still alive is the fact that this whole chapter, because I noted it when Norman seemingly died, was that it didn't feel very emotionally significant. Like, it didn't feel like there was much weight placed on Norman supposedly dying as there was when Crone actually died. And I was like, that would be weird. But
there's a lot of buildup to this, him this pouring the gasoline that. Over, reminiscing, yeah.
Like, this is definitely not a small thing. This is a pretty big deal, and I think I compare it to the Game of Thrones moment, the Red Wedding, so much, is because I know a lot of people have, you know, recited their experiences that I've read, and a lot of people said the same thing, where like, I didn't know at the time if it was a good or bad twist. I just didn't know what to even think at that time. And that's what I have right now, where I don't know what to think. I need to see next week's chapter. I need time to, like, digest this. I need to see where this goes from here. Because if this is the end of Rey, I mean, this is insane. Like, we've been following this series for 30 chapters. He was kind of introduced to us as one of the big three, the main characters of this series. And he dies in a very unceremonious way in the midst of this idea, like, we're going to help you escape. Like, these are going to be, like, the tensest next, like, 10 or so chapters where what happened? Like, do the kids even try to escape? Like, how does Emma, who's already, like, been battling real depression over Norman's loss, now recover when Ray's just killed himself? Like, I don't know what. I don't even know what to say. It's
going to be very interesting, too, because now, you know, because we had this buildup of the three musketeers, really, through so much of this series, especially, you know, when it looks like they had hatched the plan to hide Norman away, and they had that great moment of them all holding on to each other. And now Emma is entirely on her own. She's got Dawn and Gilda to help her out, but she's the only one there of the three main characters. And seemingly it looks like for a short while at least, she's just going to be on her own until presumably something happens eventually where one or both of them come back.
All I could say is this. If Rey truly is gone, and this series does get an anime adaptation, for everybody who's listening, I strongly urge you to keep that shit under wraps. Because you do not... This seems like the thing you do not want to accidentally let loose about. Because this is beyond words to me right now. This is absolutely just like, what the heck just... Can you think of another Jump series that ever showed a child willingly self-immolating themselves? Like,
he's 12, guys! He set himself on fire and he's 12!
I mean, it's crazy. I don't know what else to say. I can tell you right now, this isn't even my chapter of the week because I still don't know how to feel about this. But it's definitely the most significant chapter of the week, I'll tell you that.
And there's absolutely no heartbreak whatsoever in the next chapter that we're covering.
Yes, this is Seven Deadly Sins, I guess. This is one of those weird not chapters. This is chapter 211.5.
This is when, you know, the mangaka is like, if I title it negative 200, then that means I'll have...
So, it might be a little hard for me to exactly recall everything that happened, because I read this basically as soon as I came home and didn't have a tremendous amount of time to digest everything. But this is essentially telling the story of Gowther as the doll form of Gowther, that we've basically known throughout the series. So it starts with him as the doll waking up and being like, where am I? And he is, interrupted by a young girl who is, Nadja is her name, or I don't know if it's Nadia. Maybe
I think it's Nadja. That looks like a J to me.
Well, it is a J, but I don't know how you pronounce it. Like, it's like the Spanish kind of J where it's like Naya or something like that. I call it Nadja, I guess. She basically finds Gowther and they have a little bit back and forth. Gowther's kind of just weird and perverted for a moment. Talking like squishes her boobs.
You are a girl, which means you have squishy boobs. Boink. Yeah.
I know these things. And she just kind of slaps him. He appeared underneath Lyonis Castle and basically gets taken in with her. And her, I guess this is her, probably her older brother, I'm assuming. I don't know if they specifically note if he's the older brother or just a little bit younger than her. But basically her brother who's very close to her age. And what essentially happens is he kind of convinces Gowther to come in and start actually working. Like, they share time. The sister keeps sneaking into the bottom of the castle to meet with Gowther and gives him books and shows him all these different things. And, you know, Gowther even, like, you know, shows off his doll powers of having, you know, the ability to change his physical appearance, how he just has, like, a heart flowing in his hollow body, all those sorts of things. But then the girl starts falling ill and nausea, and they, you know, had to take her back to her room, and the brother basically dresses Gowther up as a maid so that he can come to the room and be with her, essentially, to, you know, trick the rest of the castle staff into thinking nothing's weird so he doesn't have to bring some person up there. I like how they note, like, what if he develops some weird fetish off of you dressing her, like, dressing him like a maid? I was like, does Gowther even gender identify anymore? I don't even know if he does.
Gowther is a doll.
I'm like, does he even have genitalia in any way?
I mean, apparently.
Yes. Apparently he does.
Either that or he's just like bumping a completely featureless plastic thing against her vagina at the end. Dunk, 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 dunk.
So, Gowther's very happy that he gets to be with her because he doesn't want to be lonely anymore. He wants to be happy. And there's two brothers. There's also a younger brother. Well, I believe he's shorter. I can't tell if he's younger or not. I'm just going off shorter. And he's just like, huh, is that, you know, well, she seems so happy. She just thinks this new, you know, maid of hers. What's up with that? And the older brother's like, who knows? Snidely whiplash, mustache twirling the innocence. They have fun together. Nausea and Gowther have these, you know, nice moments. They, you know, go on adventures together. They read together. They dance together. They have all these sorts of fun things. She, gives him, like, special clothes and all these sorts of things. They go horseback riding together. They have all these wonderful things. And her brother, her older brother, says, like, you know, I'm so glad that you've been around because, you know, I've been seeing her in my dreams smiling so happily, and it's very nice, but the nausea is getting sicker and sicker, and Gauther starts realizing that she's going to die. That she's dying, and he's going to lose someone again, and she can't do it anymore. You know, she's not able to, but she's thanking Gauther for everything. And, you know, he never had freedom, but, Gauther, I guess, actually, I'm not sure if it's supposed to just be a narrator or if someone else is supposed to be saying this. I guess it's just the narrator. He says, Gauther.
This is Gauther the doll talking about Gauther, the demon, angel, whatever guy.
Okay. Gauther never had freedom. That is why he created me, to connect with the world. I was his ears, his eyes, and his hands. Then just before he passed away, he left me the message to make the dream I could never have come true. But I do not even know what that dream means. And they start, basically, they fuck. They share a moment together.
They have this big romantic kiss, and then their clothes are on the ground and they're in bed together.
Now, to note, it is tastefully done. It is not, like, exploited to be like, oh, boom, bang, 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 bang. No, it's like, you know, it's shots to show that they're both in this very emotional moment, and it is a weird moment, but it is also a moment of a lot of beauty to it, and she passes.
It's a very intimate scene, yeah.
She presumably passes basically right after, it seems. Her heart stops. Gauther doesn't really know what to do. He's confused. He's screaming, I want to be with you. And then this is where things get kind of weirder again. So I guess Gauther realizes, like, oh, everybody will just go. So I believe the implication here is he's like, maybe I could put my heart into you. So he just dismembers this dead body, like, just
tries
slams.
To stuff his, he's tries to stuff his heart into her body.
Yeah, tries to basically, like, and he gets to that point, like, when guards walk in, they see Gauther, nude, over is she a princess or just a royal?
I'm not entirely sure.
Guards come into her, Nadja's room, to see Gauther naked over her bloodied body that he's already, like, torn his way through to try to put his heart into her, and he's just begging her to not leave him.
And it of course didn't work. The heart that he has is not giving her life or anything.
Nope, it will not work. So he is arrested and sentenced to death for the crime of lust, for seducing the princess. Okay, she is a princess. And not only deflowering her, but also murdering her in the most brutal manner. Your actions are inexcusable, and you will be burned at the stake as a heinous criminal. So now we know why Gauther is the seven deadly sin of lust. And I think this is actually a very fine way of addressing that.
I mean, we've always kind of noted, like, he's not so much emotionless as he is just a complete dickbag. But, you know, this explanation for why he doesn't have emotions, you know, make perfect sense. This ability that the original Gauther gave him, this heart, gave him the ability to feel emotions. But he was so hurt by this experience that he doesn't want emotions anymore. He doesn't want to be hurt like that ever again. He doesn't want to feel connection to things. He wants to be nothing more than a doll. Mm-hmm. And this way of going about establishing that, you know, it's a nice tragic backstory. I feel like from this chapter that I could definitely get a lot more into the character of Gauther. I think that I have a much greater sense of optimism for the potential of the character now.
Yes, and it should be noted that the younger brother is furious that he did this, but the older brother stops him, saying, I know that, like, it happened, but he's not that kind of person that would have done this for evil. And in the end, our sister got to die with a smile on her face, so let it be. And presumably that's how he then escapes being executed, gets to join the Seven Deadly Sins, goes on from there. But yeah, it ends with Gauther basically saying, I don't want to be anything more than a doll, if that's what having emotions means. And It's solid. It works, definitely. I guess it's just weird to me that this is considered a side chapter when I'm like, this seems like a, like,
it's an integral part of the story.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know why this would be, because, like, when the collective volume comes out, this chapter's in there, right? Because this is important.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as chapter 11.5, it doesn't make sense to me. But otherwise, yeah, I think this is a very fine story. I apologize if I was a bit slow in following everything, but I was basically catching up on some details as I was reading the story a second time through.
Yeah. Pretty good. Okay, let's move on then to Black Clover. All right, so we're on chapter 103, A Fun Festival Double Date. And so, yeah, Kahono has convinced Hiato and Asta and Noelle that they all need to go on double dates, which is why the four of them are the characters listed in the character roster at the start of the chapter, along with Yuno, who is the most important of all of them. He's also having a double date, but just not there anywhere in the chapter, I guess. And we get a little bit of into the thoughts of the three that Kahono is dragging along, because Noelle is like, oh, this is so bold. Does Kahono have feelings for Asta? And Kev's like, haha, good job, little sister, trying to get me and the sea gods together. I'm going to do my best. And Asta's like, a double date? What's that?
There are literal moments where I truly wonder if Asta is too dumb to live. Like, I get the idea he can't get the notion, but you know what the individual terms mean.
Interestingly, Kahono is actually doing the opposite of what her brother thinks, because her plan, seemingly, is to invoke a sense of jealousy in Noelle by kind of, like, aggressively getting along with Asta, because she's like, you know, come on. If you don't do something, we're going to just, you know, enjoy it together. You've got to fight to win or your wish won't come true. So her roundabout way of being wing girl, I guess. While screwing over her brother. Because like, it really kind of sucks for Kiyota because he's trying to impress his date while Kahono and Asta are getting along with each other. And it was just like, oh, why am I jealous?
In, like, almost every scene, you can just see Kyoto in the background trying to do something to impress Noelle, and she's just not paying attention. Like, anything says him, like, hey, want to go dancing? She's just like, I can't believe this is happening!
Just looking directly over Kahono and Asta. There's also a scene, like, where they're at a shooting gallery together. I guess magic shooting gallery. Mm-hmm. And if I'm getting this right...
Well, it's magic shooting guns. Because Asta has no magic, he can't fire anything. And because Noelle has too powerful magic that's uncontrolled, her gun's just exploding with power.
Noelle is, you know, continuing to be jealous. And then Kahono kind of whispers to Asta, is like, hey, what is Noelle to you? And Asta's like, well, let's see. But then they get interrupted by a crying girl. So Asta, you know, starts to have a quick gut reaction. It's like, oh, you know, are you okay? But he's kind of distracted by, we shabby mess. Your parents and presents gave you a firework. It's just so noisy. Parents and so razor kids, right? They don't even have faces. Just evil douchebag silhouettes. They're criticizing a crying girl. How evil can you be?
It's, you know what? I'm so glad we get to have the evil douchebags in Black Clover voice back again. It's been too long since somebody's just
it's been almost 2 years.
Since someone's been so nonchalantly just fucking sinister towards people for nothing more than their caste system bullshit.
Oh, God. And Asta remembers the words of the sister who raised him, that, oh yes, you know, only people with powerful magic can live in the upper realm. There's prejudice against commoners with weak magic, even though we're all the same humans. But before Asta can do anything, Noelle just takes the initiative and steps forward and is like, I love how bluntly she handles this, because she's like, what's wrong? Why are you upset? I can't understand you if you cry. Pull yourself together. Have dignity. So Asta gets a light bulb idea, like freaking light bulb lighting over his head. And so he's like, look here, little girl, and just takes over like a random juggler's act, you know, balancing in a ball and juggling. And Kona's like, oh, I will sing a song about this. And Kona's like, and I shall dance along with you, Superman Asta. And and Noel, like, use her wand so the water is rushing around them. So it's this very bizarre group effort to cheer up this one little girl. I swear to God, if you, like, had no context for what was going on, you would not be like these brain dead evil douchebags who are suddenly like, oh, wow! You'd just be like, what the fuck are they doing?
That man's swinging swords around precariously at a ball that's now on water, which is very slippery and easy to lose your balance on. And that girl's singing about how dumb he is. I don't trust this at all.
Literally, the lyrics are, dumb, dumb, dumb. Asta the Superman, there's nothing he can't do. He's little, but his voice sure is huge. He's dumb, but his muscles sure do bulge. He can't use magic, but he slashes through every spell. He can't use magic, but I can tell there's nothing he can't do. Super, super, Superman Asta.
Way to reduce him to nothing but his physical appearance, Kahono.
This is why we need Meninism.
Meninism.
We need to take the red pill and realize that women are protected so that they can sing diss songs criticizing men and reducing them to the size of their muscles.
I just love the term Meninism so much.
I did not think of that term, by the way.
Oh, that's great, though.
All right. So the girl has calmed down now because this entertaining and not at all concerning display. Kyoto, poor Kyoto, is like, I offer this dance to you, my sea goddess, still dancing in the background while Noelle has returned her focus to the little girl. And she's like, hey, you know, all right, what's your name? And she's like, I'm Emma. Oh, we have to go and save the orphanage.
Someone save Ray.
Magic to save Ray.
You know what, Nick? If you wanted me to get on board with Black Clover, that's what happens. They go in and save Ray and get those kids out of the orphanage. I will give Black Clover every chapter of the week from henceforward if they can go in and do that.
That's the dark secret of the Clover Kingdom. The Emperor is raising children to be eaten by the demons to support him.
Imagine if fucking the Promised Neverland's problems could be solved as easily as Mars walks in and says, I'm just gonna brain control everyone to let you out. What are you guys coming with these complicated plans for? Why don't you just use blood magic to manipulate your enemies?
Oh, man. All right. So Noelle is like, okay, Kahono, use your song magic to broadcast this girl's name, and that way we can get her mother's attention. And, you know, it's a quick time skip happens, and her mother shows up. They thank Noelle for, you know, reuniting them. And so the mother notices the crest that Noelle has on her dress. She's like, wait, you're a royal from the House of Silva? And all of the douchebag commoner people who are criticizing are like, excuse me, sorry, mistress. It's only Silva here. She's royal. And Noelle's like, yes, I am royal. We're said to have the best magic in this country. And for that very reason, we should extend a helping hand to everyone. Getting a swollen head, thinking you're better than the rest, and looking down on others is something only those with shallow hearts do. You can enjoy the festival too, Emma. Royal or aristocrat, commoner or pauper, it doesn't matter. Everyone can have fun together. And everyone's like, yay!
Why does everyone say yay? Wouldn't the
I don't know.
When the nobles outside be like, shut the fuck up! Like,
little all, girl, like, you don't know better. Aren't you that girl from the Silva family that they hate?
Yeah. Like, why wouldn't the people in the back be like, boo! Get her out of here! Boo! Boo you, little girl!
I like being able to criticize people different from me with impunity. Fuck you!
Yeah, fuck you! This is what privilege is about! Abusing it! I don't want to lose that shit. But I don't
fuck off, social justice warrior.
That's a type of magic in this world, I imagine.
Social justice magic.
But I think what I love the most is, in my mind, I captioned that panel where she's shouting that for the little girl to just be like, why aren't you wearing pants?
Onee-san! Onee
son, this skirt's really weird. You should really be wearing pants. I'm so short, and this seems really inappropriate. This is public indecency. You could get put on a list for this.
Rick, really, what is this? Do you just... You getting put on a shirt and you said I was done for today dressing myself? You gonna tell me about getting my shit together? Put on a fucking pair of pants, alright?
So...
She's not wearing tights! She's not wearing tights, guys! We've seen color pages!
So ignorant ass Asta, who is observing all of this, just kind of has one of his moments where he's like, now it's time that I remember the question I was asked, and now I'll answer it, outside of the context. I like Noelle quite a bit! Bing! And so Noelle, of course, gets really embarrassed, uses her water magic to, you know, launch Asta into the sky. And Kahuna's like, a dense guy and a girl who can't reveal how she really feels. What can you do? Okay, yeah, that's their relationship. Yes, like, that's
yeah.
True.
Yeah. I mean, it is true. It's
I like how Kiatu is like, hey, what about me? Okay.
Well, actually, he's excited because he's like, Asta, did you fly away out of consideration for me?
Okay. Like, this I dude, couldn't even read that properly. Geez.
This dude just can't fucking get it.
Absolutely not. Now, the chapter's not done there. Like, that's like the perfect like end note for this whole thing. But no, we've got like four more pages to get through. So Noelle has been launched off to a different part of the festival. Meanwhile, Kahono's like, Noelle, date me this time. He's like, How does that actually go forward with your plan to, whatever. I'm pretty sure Asta's not going to get jealous over that. She's just going to be like, haha, okay. They're having fun together.
Yeah, I guess I didn't pay enough attention to that line. You could look at it as like, it's just being playful and like silly.
Right.
But in my mind, I'm just like, so what does Kiato do? Like, are you like, let's do a menage a trois date? Or are you just like, fuck him. Fuck my brother. I want to do fun things.
It'll be weird if he's there. I'm not into incest.
It's like so... he's into you, so whatever. He's got like number
yeah,
one.
It's like, oh, I shall now do the dance of sadness.
She's like, can you do a dance of sadness behind that billboard where I can't see you? He's like, as you ask. And he ways away.
If I have to see you while I'm having this hot threesome with Asta and Noelle, then I'm just not going to be able to get into it. I don't want to think about the fact that you're going to be able to see Asta nailing Noelle and your sister.
Honey, is that billboard crying?
Why, yes, I think it is. And its dancing is just so gauche.
Oh. I bet he would dance better if he only had one leg.
Honey, do you remember that robot leg fella? I wish we could sort of see him dance again.
Oh, boy. So...
Even though he has both legs back, I still carry all the negative stigma of judging him as though he's disabled. Because that's what I do with all my privilege.
Anyway, Asta comes across a hot lady being sidewalk coot called, basically. It's like, oh, she's hot. Isn't she like the daughter of some famous family? I should go talk to her. And so some large, privileged man is like, oh, you're quite charming. You shall be my companion tonight. And it's like, oh, wow, it's Baron Balmain of the House Bamilton. Oh, yeah, hang on, let me pronounce this right. That's Baron Balmain of the House Bamilton. Blah,
blah. My family likes bees.
Blah. Oh, yes, we shall take in the festival gear. Come now, come with me. I'm not asking. You're ignoring me, I see. You've got some nerve. Don't you know that women are meant to be barefoot and pregnant and naked in the kitchen? Yes.
He's like, I can't help but notice that you speak only in ellipses.
I will translate on your behalf. Yes, please, take me here, right now. You have no decency. So, Asta is like, I'm going to go and defend her honor, because I have to help everyone in order to make up for the fact that Noelle beat me to the beat helping that little girl. But suddenly, a swarm of thorny vines sweeps the man and his entourage away. And it's... Oh, okay. I see here. So Baron Balmain of the House of Bamilton was going, "Who do you think I am?" And in response, the woman goes, "That's my line. Who do you think I am?" And it turns out that she's the captain of the Blue Rose Knights. It's just that Asta didn't recognize her right away because she didn't have her stupid pointy helmet on.
I'm very glad for this, because for a moment I was like, God damn it. Rebecca is in this chapter. Fuck, I just said last week she's not an important character. Won't be in it. And I was like, oh, phew. It's just someone else who looks like her to me in my very limited knowledge of Black Clover characters.
My limited knowledge of Black Clover female characters that don't have a super distinct hairstyle.
That actually wear pants.
Fauna's going to show up in the next chapter and you're going to be like, how do I tell her apart from Noelle without her eye thingy?
Yeah, I'm like, wait, isn't that great? Who? No, you can't all be in the same place at the same time. One of you has to leave.
Thank God for Charmy having a distinct appearance. Overall, I did actually like this chapter. I really liked Noelle having this moment where, you know, she just, you know, looks really good. Completely unprompted. There's no hint at all that she has some agenda of trying to impress Asta. It's just like, no, she's learned to just be a nicer person to people, and she saw someone in trouble, and she stepped in right away. So it was nice.
Yeah, it's good that she has her moments. I it's hard for me to, like, say too much on this, because I didn't really feel all that much from this chapter. I can see where, like, the strength is in it, but there's, like, a part of me that's just, like, I can't buy into the Asta-Noelle relationship, because there's part of me that's like, I just feel like it's not going to be addressed as of this point. Like,
right. It's a main couple in a shonen adventure battle series romance, which means that it'll probably be hinted towards, and then maybe there'll be some ending where they hook up and that's it.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where it's tough to get into that, because I feel like the actual genuine emotion there isn't. Like, I get Noelle's moment and I like that. But it has to be like, well, I guess I like Noelle quite a bit. I don't know why that just doesn't, like, give me anything. Like, I feel like that is just a statement that's made. I don't actually feel, like, chemistry from that or anything. And it doesn't help that Kohano, like, actually, like, notes, like, man, what stereotypical relationship this is. I get it. It's all good. I like the end, though, where the Blue Rose Knight captain shows up and, you know, blasts some dude away with his field of thorns. Like, she looks adequately cool, or not adequately, appropriately cool from that. So I do that.
I'm just imagining, like her, you know, subordinate is like, oh, I can't believe you got such a ruckus. It can't be helped. All men are scum. And Asta comes in, not all men!
Guys, I discovered my other new magic, mansplaining! Like, he just bursts into rooms and he's just like, guys, let me tell you about push-ups! He's not even mansplaining topics that are, like, going on, like, it's two women talking about, like, so did you see the traffic today? Yeah, it was ridiculous. And he just, like, shoots out of the ground and he's just like, let me tell you guys about chin-ups!
You ladies don't know how exercise works, so let me explain.
He's not derogatory. He just explodes into rooms to mansplain.
No, that's what mansplaining is, though, Chris.
Yes.
Let me mansplain to you what mansplaining is.
True. I feel he's not vindictive with it. He just explodes into rooms to talk about shit no one cares about, and he just usurps the conversation.
Asplaining.
He explodes into, do you guys know the proper way to run laps? Where did you come from? There was only a microwave in this room. He's like, I can fit anywhere I need to explain fit how hard I work out.
All right. Let's conclude this week with chapter 860 of One Piece, 10 o'clock start. I think that I have to make a note of this requested cover page that Oda did.
I didn't see this before.
Crocodile holding an umbrella over a puppy shivering in the rain. And it's Crocodile just holding an umbrella over the saddest looking puppy dog.
It's so cute. The dog's, like, got little tears, but he's happy now. and Crocodile's getting all wet, and he's still smoking a cigar, which I feel like is going to be ruined now, but god damn, like, come on, man. I hope that dog's real. I hope Crocodile has that real dog and they're best friends.
And keep in mind that this means, this means extra because of Crocodile's weakness to water.
Nick, you just blew my mind. Like, if I was on acid right now, I'd have been like, whoa. I'd have been like, Nick, we gotta stop the podcast. I mean, also, I probably would have lost it during the Promised Neverland stuff, but I was just like, Ray can't be gone, right, Nick? And then I cry on the table for 5 minutes, only popping up to just be like, Nick, do you think my family really likes me or not? Like, just to throw existential shit. And then right back down to the puppy. Then you blow my mind, and I just pass out from probably booze at that point.
So our chapter starts with Jinbei's men leaving, and they've left Peckham's tied to a rock on the shore. I like the detail that they've also left him a bottle of water with a straw in it so that he won't die of thirst before someone finds him. Mm-hmm. Peckham's is like, I hope that Mama doesn't know about this. And they're like, yeah, that'd suck, because you know what she says? If you leave, you die. And they actually launch into this explanation that Jinbei had, you know, been preparing to leave Mama legitimately. And it wasn't that the price that she asked from him was too high. It was the fact that the rut wheel that she brought out had numbers, indicating the number of fellow sacrifices that had to be made along with me. Her price went far beyond the bounds of my one life. It was unreasonable and dishonorable. So, I mean, I think that that's, you know, some good payoff for that thing that happened, you know, that Jinbei not only was refusing it because, like, he would have died and would have been able to join with Luffy, but because, you know, his people would have been killed too. So.
Yeah, because to show a lot about who he is.
So Jinbei's like, okay, so I need you all to flee to safety. And, you know, with all the security within Mama's territory, if something happens at the party, then folks, this is going to be inward. You'll have that chance to escape. And so his subordinate was like, Jinbei, but we want to help you. And Jinbei's like, I know, but listen, one day I will join the Straw Hat crew. Let's say that I do. I would lay down my life to protect my captain, Straw Hat Luffy. The only distinction, Aladdin, is whether I do this now or later. So Aladdin was like, all right, I understand him. Just make sure that you can protect your own life as best you can. And also, you're worried about the Ryugu Kingdom too, aren't you? Into future activities, I guess.
Yeah. There's a lot that's going on in One Piece. I guess it's that thing where Oda's like, oh, we're only halfway done when we got to, like, the Fishman Island stuff, so...
Wano, Emperors.
There's also Elbaf has been hinted at for a while. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine they're not going to go there.
All right. We then cut over to where the Vinsmokes are. Reiju has caught up with them, and they're like, "Where were you? Well, you guys were partying all night, right? So I went to a quieter room to sleep in." Because she's, of course, still wants to die. Doesn't want to blow their cover. We cut away after that. To basically just the kingdom as a whole preparing for the big tea party that Mama's throwing. Everyone observes that, the Porkswagon. Now, Chris, recall a couple years ago, Croakswagon infuriated you.
It does. Porkswagon. It does. Well, that's the thing. Croaky and the Croakswagon was a fucking, like, chapter ending thing. Like, it was like, boom, the Croakswagon. I love these side puns that keep slipping into One Piece. I know, like, it's like just brilliant translation that pops. I mean, the work that had to go into translating all of fucking Mark Wahlberg, Baratago, all of his like puns into like fucking egg-based things and all that, all the work that had to go into all these food-based puns recently, I can't hate on it. I can't anymore. I love it now. Not after I did fucking, like, Boom Piece and shit like that. What right do I have anymore?
So,
I will shit on Dorksta still, though. That is just awful.
We get introduced to a lot of the bigwigs that are showing up at Mama's party. There's all sorts of people who have, you know, they're crime kingpins and stuff like that who have control over various things. We also are introduced to the president of the World Economic Journal, Big News, Morgans, who is this Birdman. It's like, huh. Well, he does have birds deliver the news everywhere, I guess. So
Nick, it's big news. It's the best news.
It's huge.
It's huge news. I can't hear big news without immediately being like, it's feeling like it's Donald Trump saying it. What blows my mind, though, is this is a 2-page spread, you know, and there are moments where you get introductions to characters who aren't ultimately all that significant. But something like this, with this kind of focus, makes you be like, holy shit, is Oda introducing 6 new characters who are going to be important going forward?
Crime lords, yeah.
They're all different. It's a loan shark, someone who's the queen of the pleasure district, what seems like maybe a drug peddler. I mean, he's just called Major Undertaker, but his name's Drug Peklo, which is an awesome name. You know, someone who's a warehouse, leader, so he knows where to hide things. Someone who's great at shipping. You're just like, holy shit, like, and they all have distinct designs too. You're like, wait, what's gonna happen here?
And no way that you can mistake any one of them for any of the others. Maybe Giberson and Numit because they're just, you know, guys with weird beards, but. They come across a Prospero who welcomes the esteemed tyrants of the underworld, and, he prepares a shortcut for them, a candy escalator, so that they can just go straight to their destination right away. So they start to go up, there's a weird moment where, like, children are, like, gathered around them. And so he's like, oh, get along now, kids. Yeah, after 3 minutes, you can lick the candy coaster, but no sooner. He's like, huh. So he summons it, and then he just lets people eat it. Okay. Meanwhile, outside of the party, Capone is, you know, watching the gates with his men, and a man shows up, and he's like, I'm here. See, is Big Mom already here? See, I had an invitation from the previous party, but sadly, I was unable to attend. It was my mother's funeral. I wrote my reasons in a letter, but what do you think Big Mom sent me? And all of a sudden, he gets shot in the fucking head and falls over. And Capone's like, who? That was a guest! But from up above the gate, a man says, he was going to say, what do you think Big Mom sent me? My hospitalized father's head. And I've come here today for revenge. Open the gate. Blam, blam. Then he opens fire. He shot 2 of your men. And they recognize that it is Charlotte Katakuri, the second son of Big Mom, who has a 1,057,000,000 berry bounty. And holy shit.
And he just killed that man with a fucking jelly bean.
He just flicked a jelly bean into his forehead and killed him. And so he's like, so before all that happened, I threw a jelly bean at him. Was that a mistake, Beige the Rook? Tell Mama that it was my call. And now you'll say, all right, will do. And Capone thinks to himself, this guy's the biggest source of trouble at the party. His color of observation hockey is so refined he can actually see the near future. No wonder he's worth a billion. All right, will do.
So,
this guy is so badass.
Now, is this... Have we seen... Yeah, this will be the third general then, because we've seen Cracker, or Biscuit. No, we had the Biscuit Fruit. His name was Cracker. We've seen Smoothie already, which is the one daughter who's in, like, in the next page. And then this guy. This guy is easily, to me, the most significant member of the three of them. I look at that, and I'm like, holy shit, that dude is fucking ridiculous.
He looks almost like he belongs in freaking Mad Max with all that freaking leather.
he's almost too over-designed to the point where you're just like, holy shit, he's so over-designed, he's designed perfectly. Like, he's,
I mean,
like,
if he had,
hold on.
If he hadn't just, if he hadn't just had that badass entrance with the jelly bean killing, he would look absolutely ridiculous.
He's like, but hold on. I don't think my outfit has enough spikes and skulls on it yet. Or belts.
I need more straps that do nothing around my leg.
Like, somewhere out there, fucking, the design guy from Kingdom Hearts is watching this and is just like,
He beat me to it. He has too many. I wanted that design.
Oh, thank God he doesn't have any zippers so I can improve upon it.
Nomura, that's it, yeah.
Oh, man. So, we cut around a little bit. We do see, Smoothie, greeting the, Kings of the Underworld as they show up. And, there's a weird moment because, they're like, oh, what's on the menu today? Well, I've got Mount Mori Lava, Babe who stabbed 100 men, and weird screaming giraffe.
At first, I just thought they were weird names for drinks until I saw on this panel, like, no, there's actually hanging fucking a rock, a chick, and a giraffe head.
So she's got hardened lava and a woman who apparently is guilty of stabbing 100 men and a weird screaming giraffe. And she's making smoothies out of them, like the way that she did with when she was first introduced. And yeah, she's the server. It's even creepier when she's serving the drinks to people than when she drinks it herself, isn't it?
Ugh. It's like I'm almost sitting there. I'm like, how do you get the smoothie? Like, the giraffe's still alive. Is that woman still alive?
Is the lava alive?
Well, the lava's always alive in my heart.
No. Yeah, everyone, you know, I guess exchanges pleasantries for a little bit. And then Big Mom arrives and, you know, greets everyone. She says, look to your left, look to your right. Everything you see is eatable. Edible. I mean, you can eat almost everything you see. Come with me, and
I want to see fucking, like, Dufeld, one of the, like, the new guys they introduced, just turns over, takes a big bite out of, like, the drug guy, like, oh! She's like, She's like, you lied! You said everything was edible! She's like, well, I didn't mean the other guests! I thought that went without saying, you didn't say that! I want my money back! She's like, you didn't pay to come here!
I invited you!
We'll see about that. Stop angry.
Yeah, she just says, you know, have a good time. You're in for a real show. And that's where the chapter ends. You know, despite the fact that it's, you know, just continuing the slow build to this, you know, attempted assassination plot, I had a really good time reading this chapter. Mostly because I was like, holy shit, that guy in that stupid looking leather is fucking awesome.
That dude's just way too fucking cool. I'm glad they introduced him so much. And that bounty's ridiculous.
1 billion. And I freaking buy it when he's just like, I knew what that guy was going to do, so I killed him with a jelly bean.
I love that One Piece will have a character with that design, and his method of fighting is flicking jelly beans into people and killing them with it. I have my D&D group that I've mentioned before, the live group I play with, and I was trying to explain One Piece to them and, like, how they definitely should watch it because it's really fun. And my first thought in my mind is like, oh, I should show them Kaku versus Zoro. And I'm like, hold on, wait. Am I going to have to stop to explain why this man has giraffe powers and how that's awesome? It's that notion of
someone actually point, in the chat actually pointed out maybe the giraffe is Kaku.
Oh, that'd be heartbreaking. I don't think I could take that.
This is where he ended up. I don't know, but, yeah, cool way to set the scene, honestly. And I like all the danger that is being built up, the Straw Hats and Capone's group are getting into by trying to do this plan. Mm-hmm.
It's nice throwing in this early element of, Katagiri to basically say, like, someone out there can see the direct future if need be.
Mm-hmm. So there you go. That is gonna do it for Weekly Manga Recaps. We're going to go over our favorites for this week, starting with favorite series, favorite chapter.
This is a little bit of a tough one, but I think I'm going to go with Seven Deadly Sins this week. I like this chapter, Seven Deadly Sins. I like that we got Gowther's story in this. I like that it was actually an emotional and kind of moving story. I mean, we didn't know this girl for all that long, but you do get the real sense of there being like a tangible kind of chemistry between them. And that grief that came from her dying and what Gowther ultimately does and why he would then become kind of a distant, emotionless person after that. It all makes a lot of sense. So I thought it was a very effective way to kind of explain his sin in a satisfying manner.
And I totally understand that. Seven Deadly Sins was kind of a late contender for me, but I am going with The Promised Neverland. I know that it's not yours because you don't really know how to react to such a ridiculous chapter yet. But for me, I mean, it was a huge shock when it happened, but it was also just a really cool chapter. So I'm happy to go with that. And this is, I think, pretty easily the easiest one to call for the favorite chapter poll in the chat room. Promised Neverland got 78% of the vote.
Yeah, it's a significant chapter. No other way to phrase that. So, I'm gonna give my character MVP or character of the week then to Ray. That's a no brainer for me. I don't think anyone else could. Even though I don't know how to feel about that chapter quite yet, I know without a doubt Ray left the biggest impression on me this week.
Still get that. I went actually for Noelle and Black Clover. She really actually surprised me the most out of individual characters this week. You know, Ray's path of action, once he was explaining, I was like, okay, I can totally see him doing something like this. But with Noelle, I was just like, oh, that's nice. You know, there was no like, oh, I'm going to impress somebody or any like need for anyone to push her into acting. She just did it herself, and it shows the amount of development that she's actually, it shows that she's come a long way in the last 2 years of publication for those series. So I like that.
Yep.
And so that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. We record the show here on hitbox.tv/RollerTee and twitch.tv/RollerTee Wednesdays, usually at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But sometimes we do need to change things up. So you should follow us on Twitter to stay updated and all that stuff. The official Twitter account of the podcast is at WMR Podcast, and your hosts are at RollerTee and at YRollerOfTime. You can also check out our past episodes by going on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, as well as by subscribing to us on both iTunes and YouTube. And if you do those, then also be sure to leave a comment. If you do it on iTunes, then you will help us in our continuing battle to triumph over our rivals, the Woodworking Podcasts, in the hobby section.
So, guys, Wood today held a very significant victory over a great power, where a wooden ship was able to conquer the Dragon of Magic, Acnologia. Wood's going strong right now. But guys, just like the Evil League of Evil, we can triumph if we band together. We can defeat them. This menace can be stopped, but we need to band together by leaving 5-star reviews for Weekly Manga Recap on iTunes.
If you want to get in contact with us, you can email us, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Give us feedback. Ask us questions for us to answer in a Q&A episode in the next few months. We'll get to it probably in September. And also suggest future manga for us to read. We are, of course, going to be covering Blue Exorcist hopefully next week, but we are still always taking recommendations for future series to try out. Yes. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to do all sorts of bonus content for you guys. We had a very busy beginning to the week, getting our second commentary of the month done with Digimon, as well as our bonus episode, which is the first in a kind of experimental line of bonus podcasts that we're doing, which is WrestleMania Explained Through Manga.
Yes.
And so check that out. Basically, we go over some of the things for the big wrestling show that is happening this Sunday, and I do my best to update Chris on what's going on using as many manga metaphors as I possibly can. We had a good time doing it, and let us know how you like that. And, of course, a special thanks to the guys who help us make the podcast what it is, Steve Mann and Infamous Planet. Infamous Planet does the frame around us. He's British and can't be bothered. And Steve Mann's got his own different places where you can check out the artwork that he does for us. He puts it up for free on patreon.com/Steve Mann. But be forewarned that most of the places he shares his art, he also shares his NSFW art.
Yes, which may very well be your thing. So definitely.
I mean, hey, if that only causes you to check it out more, then yeah, there you go.
Good things. Real quick, I also want to give a special shout out to our newest patrons. I'm going to start with the newest ones because I'm working my way up to this last name here. So special thanks to August Leroy, the Autumn King, Graham Cannon, and Oscar Boroquez? Bajoroquez? Bojo Arquez? Bajoroquez? Bojo Reckless.
Let me take a crack at this. Hang on a second.
Bohoroquest. Bobo Quest. Bajoquest.
Oh fuck. How do I access the list of fucking patrons? God damn it.
Bayarwez. I think I nailed it. One of the names in there, I had to have gotten it right. But Chadawez.
All right. 15th time's the charm. All right, that's going to do it, everybody.
Anyway,
we'll catch you next week on We
Fist Bump to you guys, bam. That dude's like, all I wanted was for you to get my name somewhat close, and then you called me Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Bo-Quest. And I'm like, yeah. Give us a 5-star review already on iTunes.
Get to work.
Yeah, I'm like, come on. Get on it, Bo-Quest. Bajodo-Quest.
Bye-bye.
Bo-Bo-Bo-Quest. Next week's podcast starts, I'm still trying to do his name. I'm like, Bodo-Quest. Bodo-Bararadadas.